For me, music was always the one thing that I enjoyed the most about life.
Chester Bennington's voice shook stadiums and defined a generation, propelling Linkin Park to worldwide fame with hits like In the End and Numb.
The award goes to Linkin Park.
But behind the powerful performances and massive success was the story of a fighter who poured his pain into music that would leave a lasting impact on the world.
And that's what I remember, is this just like lightness. But then you'd hear him and it'd be like, this guy's got darkness.
This is the story of Chester Bennington. Chester Charles Bennington was born in Phoenix, Arizona on March 20th, 1976. His mom worked as a nurse and his dad was a police detective who handled tough cases involving child abuse. Bennington grew up the youngest of four children, but his childhood wasn't easy. His parents split when he was just 11, and after that, he was pretty much left on his own. He lived with his dad, but communication with his family was almost non-existent. Although he had siblings, they were rarely around, leaving Chester to navigate the tough times mostly by himself. In an interview with Kerrang, Chester reflected on how tough his teenage years were after his family fell apart. "My parents got divorced when I was 11. When my mom left, my whole family pretty much disappeared. My older brother and my older sister left home. My other sister, who's a little older than me, was hardly ever there. That left me and my dad, and he was working around the clock, pulling double shifts. I was pretty much just left at home by myself. It was horrible." Chester was always open about the horrific challenges he faced as a child. In that same brutally honest Kerrang interview, he revealed the nightmare that began when he was abused as a kid. "It started when I was about 7 or 8. It was by a friend who was a few years older than me. I was getting beaten up and being forced to do things I didn't want to do. It destroyed my self-confidence. I hated everybody in my family. I felt abandoned by my mom. My dad was not very emotionally stable. And there was no one I could turn to. The only thing I wanted to do was kill everybody and run away. The abuse lasted until he was 13, and later he turned to drugs to try and escape the pain of that time."
I started using drugs, so I was exposed to it really, really young, and there was a lot of things that happened to me as a young person that were really difficult to deal with, and I found myself alone a lot, and so given the nature of a lot of the aspects of my childhood, when that first person offered me, you know, an escape from reality, I kind of took it and I ran with it, you know.
In high school, Chester was bullied badly. He shared in an interview that he was knocked around like a rag doll because he was skinny and didn't look like everyone else. With the kind of trauma he endured, it's almost inevitable that depression would take root. His painful past created the perfect storm for the darkness to grow.
It's not like, oh man, like I kind of like that, I'm just bummed. It's like, I don't want to do anything, and I don't feel like doing anything, and I don't like anything. Like there's no sunshine. For me, I've always kind of dealt with that my whole life, you know. I've always had these kind of depressive side, and I think that's something I've never liked, but I've also never liked being anything. I don't like being I want to be happy, but when I'm in it, I try to get out of it. I don't like being sad. When I'm in it, I want to get out of it. I've never been comfortable just being. My whole life, I've just kind of felt a little off, and I find myself like getting into these patterns of like behavior or thought, and especially when I'm like stuck up here, I like to say that like this is like a, I heard somebody say this once and it like stuck with me, but this is like a bad neighborhood, you know what I mean? And I should not go walking alone.
Chester was undeniably a tortured soul, and he found a way to channel all of that pain into his music. His voice was amazing, effortlessly shifting from gentle tones to powerful screams. His songs often seemed like they gave an inside look at the struggle of mental illness. Chester himself said that when everything else in his life was falling apart, music was the only thing that kept him going.
The one I would say that music has probably kept me alive, more so than anything else. I mean, other than, you know, love from your friends and family, I think that, you know, music is probably the reason why I still am here, because that is how I get out a lot of the stuff that's going on inside of me. And that's how I kind of work through a lot of things. I reflect on my life. I reflect on how I feel.
But his path to success was filled with dead ends. As a teenager, he sang in bands that went nowhere, leading to nothing but frustration. By 1998, he was done, ready to walk away from music for good. Things weren't happening. The grind had taken its toll, and Chester almost gave up on his dream. That is, until he auditioned for a group that would later become Linkin Park.
We went through a period where we kind of didn't know what we wanted to do with the band. Like, the singer we had been playing with was transitioning out, and we didn't know if we wanted to continue. If we wanted to continue, if we did, if we wanted to continue just the five guys, or how that would even look or work out. And, you know, we tried a bunch of different guys that were LA-based and whatever, and nothing was really working, nothing we were excited about. But when we heard Chester's stuff that he had done, we were just like, okay, this guy can sing. We need to get him out here quick and see, you know, what the deal is. Got him out, and then said, okay, if a band is going to work, this is gonna work. Otherwise, you know, that's the end of Linkin Park as it is, kind of thing.
Desk jobs, here we come.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember getting a call from a friend of mine who used to represent an old band of mine, saying that, you know, there was this great young group of guys that had this really great sound, and all they needed was that voice that was going to help them complete the puzzle. And, you know, I had never really auditioned. The only time I'd ever auditioned to be in a band was when I was, like, 14. And so from 14 to 23, I had never auditioned. I was always the person that people were coming to audition for. And so it was a different experience for me, you know, because in my mind, I was, like, doing these guys a favor. And you know, I wasn't the one who called them. You know, they were calling me. And so it was strange for me to think of it as me doing an audition, because I didn't go seek them out, which was the interesting thing. So when I got there and you know, turned over the tape, I had my vocals on it, everybody liked it. We seemed to get along pretty well, even though we were strangers. And I got to watch some other people like see their auditions, and it was pretty funny.
Long story short, he ends up in LA and he tries out. Well, we had lined up a few different tryouts that day, and you know, because we didn't know what the hell we were doing, like they were seeing each other on the way in and out, which is not a very nice thing to do. I wouldn't have done it that way if I did, you know, were to do it today. But the guy who was trying out after Chester heard Chester sing, and then he came in and he was basically like, I don't know if he said it to us or if he said it to Chester. He's like, if they don't pick you, they're crazy. Like one of the guys actually left. I think it was that guy. He just came in and he was like, I'm not even trying out. Like, if you guys don't pick that guy, you're insane. And he like left and he told Chester the same thing.
It was a turning point for Chester. For the first time in his teenage life, his future looked promising and things finally started to feel hopeful. The band wasn't happy with the material they had, so as soon as Chester joined, they got straight to work writing new songs. The Hybrid Theory EP was their first release, with Chester on vocals.
Chester came out to LA just like having started in the band, and he was like kind of living out of his car and deciding, do I want to be in this band? Do they want me in this band? Like, how does it work? Before we'd started working together, Chester never really screamed on a song. He sang. He didn't like do what he ended up doing on Hybrid Theory. We discovered that together.
Talking about the EP, Mike Shinoda said, it was a small project we put together when Chester first moved to California. It was the first time we were in the studio together. They promoted their music everywhere they could online, posting links to their songs on music forums, chat rooms, and even other bands' websites. Drummer Rob Borden shared, I'd tell everyone in the band to recruit 5 or 6 people a day online. We'd go into Korn's chat rooms and say, check out this cool new band called Linkin Park, acting like we weren't actually in the band.
We're definitely a band that you can totally say, like, we kind of broke on the web. And the cool thing about that is when we first went to do a U.S. tour, which we'd never done before, there were kids in all these different cities who already knew who we were because they'd heard our stuff on the internet, or they were on our street team, or they'd met someone.
It's really distracting, man.
We really rode that way. Like, we were making fans directly on our street team over the internet. And like, that was like a new, I mean, it sounds so ridiculous, but that was like a new thing to do.
They even turned Rob's apartment into a DIY operation, spending 10 hours a day packing stickers, CDs, t-shirts, and letters to send out to fans. Even with all the buzz and excitement around it, no one could have predicted just how massive Hybrid Theory would become after its release on October 24th, 2000. It debuted at number 29 on the US Billboard 200, and within a week, it sold 50,000 copies.
The award goes to Linkin Park.
4 weeks later, it was certified gold with 500,000 copies sold, and 2 years later, it was still moving 100,000 copies a week in the US alone. Despite the huge success of Hybrid Theory, the album is often left off lists of the best metal, hard rock, or emo albums. It didn't fit neatly into any one genre. People called Linkin Park nu metal, but that label never really fit. They weren't like Korn or Limp Bizkit. Linkin Park mixed rap, screaming, and electronic sounds in a way that made it hard to put them in one box. And that made them stand out to fans while unsettling the purists.
And then we got in the studio, and like the people were like that we were working with were saying, you know, we want you to change this and change that. This guy has this gimmick where he wears a red hat, and you guys need a gimmick. For us, we were just like, come on, man. Like, what we're doing, there's a very specific lane that we're trying to go down. Like, we have a very specific idea for what this is. And it incorporates these different genres of music. I grew up in hip hop. I know hip hop like the back of my hand. It is what I like live and die by. And I want to put this very specific like type of hip hop in the music. And I know these people don't get it, but somebody out there is going to hear this and get it. That it's really, you know, the choices that we're making are what makes this album what it is.
And Chester Bennington wasn't just a frontman. He was a master of dissecting his own mind. He could explain how his anxiety would temporarily fade, only to return as a crushing wave of depression. He likened his mind's final traces of happiness to dirty water swirling down a drain. And that kind of raw honesty made Linkin Park unique.
That record means a lot. It means a lot to us. It means a lot to, it's allowed us to really know that we can stay true to who we are. We can fight for what we want, and we can take chances that we want to take. So it was a very important record for us. It set the bar for us. They're a reflection of where we are creatively, and it's the best thing that we could do with our talents at the time. That's what we always had to do. We had to set that bar high, and we learned a lot from making that record, for sure.
Hybrid Theory is loaded with potential singles. Everyone knows Paper Cut, In the End, and Crawling, but the whole album pulses with energy. It's a wild blend of moods. Dark, heavy, melodic, and emotional. It's no wonder the album immediately connected with such a wide audience. Hybrid Theory is rightfully hailed as a groundbreaking album, but in the shadow of all that praise lies one of Linkin Park's most overlooked masterpieces, Reanimation. Less than 2 years after their debut, the band unleashed this remix album, which in many ways it's arguably their most underrated work. Reanimation is where they started departing from nu metal, diving headfirst into electronic and experimental sounds. This isn't just a remix album, it's a complete reimagining. It's darker, grittier, and more akin to an underground hip-hop record. Blending elements of industrial and electronic music to create a harsher, more jarring sound, one that wouldn't stand a chance on mainstream radio. Vocally, things shift as well. Shinoda's verses come to the forefront, while Bennington's voice often takes a back seat, functioning more as hooks or getting chopped up and remixed into the production. It gives the album a fresh sound that's different from what fans were used to, but no less powerful. I do think they could have trimmed some of the fat here, but overall, it's incredibly solid and criminally underrated. After the success of Hybrid Theory and Reanimation, Linkin Park hit the road, touring across the US. They received invitations to perform at huge events like Ozfest and the Family Values Tour. They even started their own tour, Project Revolution, bringing along artists like Cypress Hill, Edema, and Snoop Dogg. Within a year, they had performed at over 320 concerts. On the surface, Chester was on top of the world, riding the wave of the band's meteoric success. But inside, he was fighting demons no one could see.
Obviously, you know, you have been thinking about the next record.
Well, as far as working on it right now, what we're doing is we're setting up a studio in the back of our bus. We did that on last tour. We're going
to
do that.
This is becoming really common, right? I mean, I've spoken to a few bands recently who want to record on the road, but they say it's not
easy. Oh, yeah, but their studios are nothing compared to ours.
right.
Ours is much bigger and much more elaborate. Well, we're really into working with, like, computer-based recording equipment, and I think we stay pretty on top of it, like, as far as the technology.
The band officially announced the production of a new studio album in December 2002, revealing that their new work was inspired by the rocky cliffs of Meteora in Greece, where ancient monasteries sit high above the ground. When Meteora debuted on March 25th, 2003, it gained worldwide recognition almost instantly. But by 2003, the music scene was shifting. Rock radio was leaning towards 70s garage rock and pop punk. Bands like Incubus and Deftones, who once were lumped into the new metal movement, were exploring new sounds. Even Limp Bizkit was covering The Who. Everyone seemed to be looking for a way out of new metal, seeking respect in new genres. Let's be real, new metal was never going to win over the music elite. Linkin Park knew this, and it pissed them off. So when they went into the studio for Meteora, they made a choice. They weren't just going to stick to the formula, they were going to evolve, whether anyone liked it or not.
I think Chester was on board first and foremost, maybe even leading the charge on it, is like, let's do it our way or let's not do it. Like, he was a champion for that in so many ways, even coming into Meteora.
So they threw everything into the mix. They flipped acoustic guitars backward on Somewhere I Belong and sampled Japanese flutes for Nobody's Listening. These weren't just cheap tricks. They were a middle finger to anyone who said they couldn't experiment. Sure, the songs were more layered, harder to digest at first, but when they landed, they slammed, and nothing hits harder than Faint. Faint isn't just a highlight, it's the moment of the album. It crushes everything else around it, turning skeptics into believers. It's as if the band heard Outkast's B.O.B. and made their own version of it. With breakbeat samples and wild strings, Faint doesn't just demand your attention, it grabs you by the throat. It's undeniable. Then there's Breaking the Habit, a song that stands out for its own reasons. Musically, it's the most beautiful track on the album, mixing a Depeche Mode vibe with big cinematic orchestral sounds. After Chester Bennington's death in 2017, this song takes on a whole new meaning. The pain in his voice feels all too real now, and it's hard not to hear Breaking the Habit as a cry for help.
Something else.
Three, two, one, go.
The thing that I remember about Chester, my prevailing top image in my head is this kid who could pull it out of him deep, like Layne Staley deep, like the tar that's in there. But he's so goofy. He was so goofy. Like, his humor was so goofy, and at times, if he was in that mood, he'd just be this insatiable, like, I've got too many jokes and too many things and too many impressions and too much of this. And that's what I remember, is this just like lightness. But then you'd hear him and it'd be like, this guy's got darkness and has to find it. That's a rare combination.
In recent years, Mike Shinoda has shared how Chester would disappear on wild nights out while touring and come back completely wrecked. It must have been tough for Shinoda and the rest of the band to watch their friend struggle with something so deep. Breaking the Habit was meant to be an instrumental at first, but Shinoda eventually felt compelled to write lyrics. Maybe he hoped the song would reach Chester, showing him he wasn't alone. The band dropped 5 singles from Meteora: Faint, Breaking the Habit, From the Inside, Somewhere I Belong, and the massive Numb. These singles weren't chosen at random. Each one was picked to show that Linkin Park and nu metal were evolving. It was a smart move, and it worked.
Hybrid Theory was like us against the world, like with the story Mike and Dave are recounting. It was like having to fight just to get our actual authentic point of view across. And what was like both so liberating and terrifying about Meteora is like no one effed with us on Meteora.
We got away with it.
It was like, okay, you guys did it. Dude. Now, what do you really want to do? And like, this album was the total pure expression of just like, this is us, like, delivering, you know, what we want to make. And it was really a fun album to make. Like, Hybrid Theory was stressful. Yeah. This album was awesome. Like, it was so great.
Suddenly they were sharing stages with Metallica, a band that defined metal. And then, just to flip the script again, they teamed up with Jay-Z for Collision Course, an EP that made no sense on paper but worked perfectly in reality. Here's the point. Linkin Park wasn't chasing approval anymore. They were standing alongside the legends they'd been trying to impress, solidifying their place in both rock and rap. And they did it while keeping the fan base that made them stars in the first place.
You know, we were a set of guys who were kind of going through a lot of crazy stuff and trying to figure it out as we went. We'd come home off of these huge world tours.
Yeah.
And it would be like, nobody's picked up the dog shit in the backyard for 2 months. So that's now my job. And it was a really quick reentry into like,
life.
You're not in a rock star band right now. Like, you've got to go do the chores.
Yeah.
This success, however, came with a personal cost for Chester. Back in 1996, he married his first wife, Samantha Marie Olite. They had a child together in 2002, just as Linkin Park was skyrocketing to fame. But with the nonstop touring and the crazy demands of being in the band, Chester's relationship with Samantha began to fall apart. And sadly, by 2005, they ended up divorcing.
Please welcome Dead by Sunrise.
That same year, Chester found another outlet for his emotions by co-founding Dead by Sunrise, an electronic rock band. Though they only released one album, Out of Ashes, in 2009, and it got mixed reviews, it was a project that allowed Chester to explore new musical directions during a tough time in his life. In 2006, Chester married Talinda Ann Bentley, a former Playboy model. Together, they had three children, but their happiness was disrupted by a cyber stalker who harassed the couple by tampering with their emails and personal information. This stalker also sent them threatening messages. Thankfully, the person was eventually caught and sentenced to 2 years in prison. All this chaos must have taken a toll on Chester. He battled drugs and alcohol for years, and in 2006, he went to rehab twice. It took everything he had, but he finally kicked the habit and got sober for good.
Life is so weird.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are periods of time where I feel like I've got it, like, all my stuff together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and then there are periods of time where I'm just like, I am such a failure at everything, and I just, like, I can't do anything right. Like, I'm a horrible dad, I'm a horrible husband. You know, I'm just like, ugh.
And then came the summer of 2007 when Linkin Park took a bold step with Minutes to Midnight. Co-produced by Mike Shinoda and the legendary Rick Rubin, the album was a big shift from their usual sound.
I'm not sure if the words are making me think of certain melodies, so I wanted to remove the words.
It's funny listening.
Critics weren't exactly praising it, but the sales told a different story. For many diehard fans, this was Linkin Park at their best, taking risks, pushing their boundaries, and proving they weren't stuck in the past. Some of the standout tracks like Shadow of the Day, What I've Done, Leave Out All the Rest, In Between, and Bleed It Out show that even with a new sound, the band still knows how to pull on your heartstrings. The emotions, the passion, and their connection to people going through tough times are all still there, just with sharper songwriting. They followed up with A Thousand Suns in 2010, which was probably their most experimental album yet. This one leaned heavily into electronic and alternative sounds, mixing rap with beats, keyboards, samples, and rhythm loops, while almost completely cutting out electric guitars.
And we would all fight amongst ourselves, but at the end of it was like, let's figure out how we want to do it, and if that's not going to work, then we don't want to do it. Like, let's make sure that we love it, and then we can put it out there and be confident in the fact that at least the six of us are on board, and we hope you like it.
Yeah.
We hope you love it. But if not, we've done all we can do, instead of like the reverse of that, which is kind of listening to the outside ideas and kind of getting that weird feeling in your stomach of like, I don't know if this is how I want to do this, or I don't know if this is how I want to create or approach this process.
I think that's one thing.
While fans love the album today, back when it first dropped, it was a lot to take in. Many people didn't fully get it or appreciate just how different it was. Say what you want about Linkin Park, but they made a choice to grow with their audience, adapt to the times, and keep pushing boundaries.
You gotta impress yourself first. You gotta make the songs that you go, damn, that's a good song. Like, if no one else likes that song, I know I'm on good footing because I think it's
but
great.
But see, these are the decisions that get made.
Living Things, released in 2012, was a continuation of the experimental route they'd set with A Thousand Suns, blending electronic and rock in a way that had critics nodding with approval. The production was sharp, the sound was a mix of the old aggressive style and new electronic influences. But fans were divided. Some embraced the balance of styles, while others were left wanting more of that hard-hitting new metal punch.
And with this album, we weren't really necessarily talking about social issues. We were talking about relationships. We were talking about human emotions. I think the only thing that we really tried to put into this album was something that Mike and I had talked about when we were touring, was let's write a bunch of songs that would be fun to play live and keep the energy up and be exciting for our fans to...
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
To get into, which kind of inspired us to go back to, you know, some of the things that some of our earlier fans would be more familiar with. Some of the things that we may have been, that we may have alienated them in some respects over the last couple albums with A Thousand Suns and with Minutes to Midnight. We've gone back to a couple of the stylistic things that people from who got into us early in our career would be more familiar with. And we mixed those with some of the things that we've learned since we began working with Rick Rubin.
The Hunting Party, released 2 years later, felt like a rebellion. It was a direct response to the softer, electronic vibes of their previous albums. The band brought the guitars back in full force, delivering an album that was raw, aggressive, and unapologetically loud. Some fans hailed it as a return to form, while critics saw it as a bold statement against the watered-down trends in mainstream rock. Although some argued it lacked the innovation they'd come to expect from Linkin Park. Then came One More Light in 2017, which shocked everyone. One More Light got a mixed to negative response when it came out in 2017. The main issue for critics and fans was that it sounded more like a pop album than what they were expecting from Linkin Park.
So it seems that this new Linkin Park album, it's not good. This is the opposite of what a band of Linkin Park's history and caliber should be doing at this point in their career. It's like they're trying too hard to appeal to a generation of listeners who it's just not going to happen. It's never going to happen. All you're going to do is alienate and tick off the listeners who have stuck with you from back in the day. And believe me, at this point, you want those people to continue riding with you. You don't want to shake that boat. You don't want to kick them off the bus because they're going to leave if you come out with another album like this. They're going to go.
Despite this, it did well commercially, debuting at number one on the Billboard 200, showing that the band still had a strong fan base.
There's a reason why all six of us voted for those tracks. It's because they're amazing songs, dude. Like, I was even trying to just sing, like, a whatever vocal in here for One More Light, dude. I started fucking crying, dude. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of record we're making.
But the reception highlighted the challenge artists face when changing their sound and identity. What's baffling is why a band with such a versatile history, from nu metal and rap rock to grand symphonic pop rock, caught so much backlash for doing something different. If these 10 songs had been spread out as occasional ballads on future albums, more fans probably would have embraced them. Instead, the fact that all these pop songs were crammed into one 40-minute album seemed to be what set people off. They were so hung up on the idea of a soft Linkin Park that they didn't even give the album a fair shot. For those who do give One More Light an open-minded listen, there's plenty to like. The catchy choruses in Good Goodbye, the beautiful guest vocals from Kiara on Heavy, the thoughtful lyrics in Halfway Right, and the unique vibe of Sharp Edges all show that the band could still make great music, whatever style they choose to adapt.
This morning, the music world is remembering grunge rock pioneer Chris Cornell.
Breaking news update. In the last 15 minutes, the medical examiner has confirmed that rocker Chris Cornell has committed suicide.
On May 26th, a week after one more light dropped, Chester Bennington found himself giving the most raw, heart-wrenching performance of his life. His close friend Chris Cornell, the voice of Soundgarden, was being laid to rest at Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Cornell had unalived himself after a lifelong battle with depression. Chester stood before the mourners and his voice cracked with emotion as he sang Hallelujah for his friend. That day, his voice was different, plaintive, somber, and more fragile than ever. He also paid tribute to his friend on Twitter. Your voice was joy and pain, anger and forgiveness, love and heartache, all wrapped up into one, and I suppose that's what we all are. You helped me understand that. And then, 64 days later, Chester tragically unalived himself.
Bennington was found dead in a home near Los Angeles Thursday morning. Authorities say it may have been suicide.
In the days before his death, Chester had been in Arizona, trying to find a bit of peace with Talinda and the kids at their cabin in Sedona. It was a family escape before Linkin Park's massive North American tour was set to kick off later that month.
Something else.
Three, two, one, go.
I got a good cow. I got a good cow in my mouth.
But Chester didn't stay long. He went back to Los Angeles alone, saying he had work to do. Before he left, Talinda captured what would become a haunting memory, a photo of Chester and their kids standing on the deck, grinning from ear to ear as they looked out into the woods. A picture that now feels like a final moment of happiness. On the morning of July 20th, Chester Bennington was found dead by hanging in his home. The date was significant. It was the birthday of his close friend, Chris Cornell. Just a month earlier, Chester had confided in his friend Ryan Shuck, who played guitar in his side project Dead by Sunrise, that he was struggling with alcohol addiction again and fighting hard to get sober. Despite this, family and friends said that Chester seemed to be in good spirits, happy, energized, and excited for the upcoming tour. We'll never know for sure if his decision was something he had planned or a tragic impulse, but there's something worth noting. When someone struggling with suicidal thoughts seems suddenly cheerful or relieved, it can be a dangerous sign.
I either got rotten egg or something else.
Three, two, one, go.
It's a change that often occurs when they've made up their mind, and it's one of the most critical warnings to look out for.
He was at his best before he passed. We were on a family vacation, and he just had to go back home to do a television commercial, and we were, I was going to see him the next day. It was just the timing of it. You know, he had been in states of depression before, and he had had past attempts. This was not a time where we, any of our families, suspected this to happen, which is terrifying, you know, because it could happen at any moment with those thoughts.
Following Chester's death, blog posts and message board discussions started popping up, with many suggesting that One More Light was a cry for help that had gone unnoticed. Conspiracy theories quickly arose, claiming that Chester and Chris Cornell didn't just die by tragic coincidence. According to some, the two were deliberately taken out because they were secretly working to expose a dark network of abusers. We're trying to remind ourselves, the band wrote to Chester following his death, that the demons who took you away from us were always part of the deal. After all, it was the way you sang about those demons that made everyone fall in love with you in the first place.
Did you doubt at any time that, like, oh, now Chester's gone, maybe I don't want to do music anymore? Was there any of that?
Yeah.
No.
Of course. 100%. Yeah. 100%. It's like, for me, it just felt like too much.
Mm.
Like, to get back on it and try and do some version of music and also be seen through the lens of what had happened.
Yeah.
Like, for that to be attached. It was like being a member of a club that I didn't want to join.
The truth is, we'll never know why the darkness that haunted Chester his entire life won out on July 20th, 2017. From the outside, he was a beacon of light, spending time with family, sharing laughs with friends, practicing his new songs, and getting ready for his tour. But all of that fought against years of deep trauma, addiction battles, and crushing depression. To suggest there's a simple reason for his death, or to claim his music was some kind of warning we all missed, is to ignore the complexity of his struggle. There are no neat explanations, and there never will be. Chester Bennington's legacy is one of strength, emotion, and lasting influence in the world of music. As the frontman of Linkin Park, he became a voice for a generation, turning his struggles with pain, addiction, and mental health into powerful lyrics that resonated with fans everywhere. His voice, with its mix of raw emotion and intensity, helped shape rock music in the early 2000s, creating a unique sound that blended metal, hip-hop, and alternative rock. But Chester's impact went beyond the music. He challenged us all to be real about our struggles. His openness about addiction, pain, and mental health issues sparked conversations and inspired countless people to seek help. The vulnerability and strength he put into his art still live on through his songs, reminding us that even the darkest battles can give birth to something beautiful.